Okay, thank you for coming back. One thing I wanted to say right now that would be somewhat satisfying to you, I feel, because you just studied this so hard. I'm going to take you back to this figure that you'll remember studying for today's test from near the end of the TCA cycle when we talked about, as the caption says, efflux of intermediates from the TCA cycle, like this use of TCA cycle intermediate, this use, all these drains of intermediates from the cycle. We did discuss before you put the test how those would create a situation, if it were not for anaphorotic pathways, where the cycle would run out of intermediates. And for no other reason than that, the cycle would be forced to slow down no matter how much it's needed. Hence the need for anaphorotic reaction. And you studied the reaction that I added right here in my adaptation of this figure, the reaction catalyzed by pyruvate carboxylase, that is the most important anaphorotic reaction, so I made sure I talked to that one, the reaction catalyzed by carboxylase. And the only control of that enzyme to know about is that it is activated by acetyl-CoA. I did make sure I told you that before the test. It's now expected that you know that, and I'll reassure you that that's all there is to know about the control of pyruvate carboxylase. It's activated by acetyl-CoA. And I want to describe to you now how that's a beautiful system, having pyruvate carboxylase be an enzyme that's activated by acetyl-CoA. It's a mechanism that I would call allosteric activation when acetyl-CoA activates pyruvate carboxylase. And what a beautiful system that is. You are so ready now to appreciate that. Here it goes. If these drains of intermediates from the cycle cause the number of cycle intermediates to be decreased to a small, low level, then oxaloacetate, one of those intermediates, would be few and far between. They'd be scarce. They'd be hard to find. There wouldn't be very many oxaloacetates. And here's how that situation corrects itself. It's really, that's why I call it a beautiful system, the way it corrects itself. When these drains begin to create a problem of there aren't very many cycle intermediates anymore, here's how it corrects itself in a very nice way. Acetyl-CoAs that would like to donate their acetyl groups to the cycle, as I was just saying, would have some trouble doing that because for an acetyl group to enter the cycle, it needs to find an oxaloacetate to partner with, like we sang, you know, looking for a partner. It needs to find an oxaloacetate to partner with if an acetyl group is going to enter the cycle. So when those oxaloacetates become few and far between or scarce, because of these drains of intermediates from the cycle, then the acetyl-CoAs that can't find oxaloacetates to react with begin to accumulate. There would be a very natural, you see, rise in the concentration of acetyl-CoA created by that situation. And then that rise in the concentration of acetyl-CoA turns on this enzyme, pyruvate carboxylase, which will catalyze a reaction that refills the cycle with intermediates. What a beautiful system. And you're ready to appreciate how beautiful that is now. I hope that you find it as lovely as I do. Now it's time to move on to our next objectives. These would be objectives on oxidative phosphorylation. And I think today we can, in a fairly gentle way, get a good start on that. Oxidative phosphorylation, learning objectives. The main chapter for that is going to be chapter 21. And the first picture I'll take you to here in a moment is figure 21.1. This is an overview of oxidative phosphorylation, so a very good figure for the first learning objectives. Objective one, I would say, is largely review, maybe entirely review, in that we've already tried to see an overview of the aerobic use of fuels, and we have located oxidative phosphorylation as a very important process in that aerobic use of fuels. I think you've got that kind of an overview of the aerobic use of fuels and the place of oxidative phosphorylation in that well in mind already. And the TCA cycle's connection to oxidative phosphorylation, I think you already know the answer to that. The TCA cycle creating NADHs and FADH2s that then have electrons to give to the electron transport chain. And how oxidative phosphorylation includes more than just the electron transport chain. This is the electron transport chain of this picture. Oxidative phosphorylation includes all of it and also ATP synthase and what ATP synthase will catalyze. And you know how the two parts of oxidative phosphorylation somewhat work together already. I think you've got a good overview of oxidative phosphorylation already, but here it is again quickly. When electrons go from one end of the electron transport chain to the other, and at the end of the electron transport chain are given to O2 molecules, reducing the oxygens to being oxygens of waters. When the electrons go that direction, some protons are pumped from the matrix of a mitochondrion to the space in between mitochondrial membranes, the intermembrane space. That's the creation of a proton gradient. You already have this idea that the electron transport chain creates a proton gradient. And here is the picture's depiction of creating that gradient. Creating the gradient here, here, and here by pumping protons. Protons that we're really not going to try and say where they came from any more exactly than this. They came from the matrix. And they're going to the intermembrane space. And that would be a direction spoken of as pumping those protons across the membrane, because that's going against the gradient for those protons. That requires an input of energy. So where is the energy coming from for doing this pumping of protons work that the electron transport chain does? The energy for that proton pumping comes from the redox reactions within the electron transport chain. Every time the electrons change hands, that's a redox reaction. And most of those redox reactions are exergonic, and so overall there's a lot of release of energy when electrons go from one end of the electron transport chain to the other. Then, situated in that same membrane, which is the perfect place to make use of the gradient, is something called ATP synthase, which does exactly that, makes use of the gradient. Here's the picture's suggestion of protons going back into the matrix from the intermembrane space by passing through this doorway, if you want, ATP synthase. And that represents using the gradient as a power source. That's where ATP synthase gets the energy required for catalyzing this reaction. Putting ADP and P sub I together to make ATP is energy required. And where does ATP synthase get the energy to have that reaction go forwards? It gets the energy from the proton gradient across that membrane. That's the overview of oxidative phosphorylation that I hope I'm just reminding you of, because you've kind of had all this in mind already. The examination of this picture might start here. And then I would follow the electrons from this NADH all the way to here, where they're given to oxygens, reducing the oxygens to waters. The electrons start here in the picture and end up here in the picture. They end up as electrons of water molecules. That's as far as the electrons go. Don't send electrons to ATP synthase. It wouldn't know what to do with them.
when it knows how to use, is the proton gradient across the membrane. So it'll send electrons to it.
Back to where I might start my inspection of this picture, this NADH. Notice that it's an NADH in the mitochondrial matrix. That location is necessary for the NADH to give electrons to the electron transport chain like we see here. It has to be an NADH in the mitochondrial matrix. And let me remind you of three places now that you already know about that those NADHs could be coming from. Maybe it's more than three, depending on how you count them. One place that those NADHs could be coming from is the TCA cycle. When I say there's only three places, I was counting the TCA cycle as one of them. And you might say, well, there's actually three places in the TCA cycle that make NADHs. The reactions catalyzed by isocitrate dehydrogenase, alpha-ketoglutarate dehydrogenase, and malate dehydrogenase. But I'm lumping all those together and saying, these NADHs could have come from the TCA cycle. That's one place. The TCA cycle is in the mitochondrial matrix. And so these NADHs made by the TCA cycle would be in this location. Another thing that happens in the mitochondrial matrix is the pyruvate dehydrogenase reaction. And that makes NADHs in the mitochondrial matrix. So this could have come from the PDC reaction. That's how we've abbreviated pyruvate dehydrogenase, PDC. These NADHs could have come from the pyruvate dehydrogenase reaction. And the third place that I'm thinking you know about now that these NADHs could have come from and appear now in the mitochondrial matrix, that would be from beta oxidation. I've introduced now that beta oxidation makes NADHs, and that beta oxidation is in the mitochondrial matrix. So don't think that these NADHs had to come from the TCA cycle. They could, but I've added some other places that they could have come from as well. And this represents a protein, or something that's mostly protein. Overwhelmingly, what's in this package right here called complex 1, some people call it NADH dehydrogenase because it does, notice, take electrons away from NADH. This complex 1 right here might be called NADH dehydrogenase for that reason, but I'm going to call it complex 1. And what I'm going to tell you right now about complex 1 is also true about this one, complex 3, and this one, complex 4. These complexes of the electron transport chain are mostly protein. There are some non-protein helpers that the protein part is wrapped around, but they're mostly protein. When we start focusing on the electron carriers in those complexes, that's going to draw our attention to the non-protein helpers that the protein is wrapped around. But I don't want you to forget at that point that those complexes are mostly protein. This would be sort of a trivial fact, but I think there's like 42 different polypeptide chains inside complex 1. Wow, is it protein? Something like 42 different polypeptide chains and 42 subunits, if you will, to make up that complex 1. Notice that complex 1 is a proton pump, that if you send, and this is an important if you send electrons through complex 1, it will then be empowered to pump some protons from the matrix to the intermembrane space. For that to work, complex 1 needs to be protein that goes all the way through the membrane, crosses the membrane. That's kind of logical if it's going to serve as a proton pump to take protons from the matrix and move them to the intermembrane space. It needs to traverse across the membrane. All the proton pumps here are complexes that are mostly protein and cross the membrane. Someone had a hand up. Uh, I was saying that the proton pump won't pump any protons unless you send electrons through it. That those electrons moving through it, the redox reactions within it, are what provide the energy for pumping the protons across the membrane. The proton pumps don't pump any protons unless electrons go through them. Well, you got to be listening carefully to whether I said electrons or protons in this discussion. They're both involved, and they're quite different things. Electrons generally moving this direction, and protons moving that direction, or that direction, in other words, perpendicular to the direction that the electrons move. Some other components of the electron transport chain in this picture. I've pointed to complex one thus far. But then here's part of the electron transport chain called coenzyme Q. And we'll look at a picture of coenzyme Q with these learning objectives as our guide. And you'll appreciate then that coenzyme Q is not a protein. And maybe you would have guessed that already because you've picked up on the fact that coenzymes are not proteins. Think of coenzyme A. Is that a protein? No. Enzymes are almost always going to be proteins, but coenzymes are never proteins. They are cofactors or non-protein helpers. And then here's complex three, which has some electron carriers inside it that we'll look at eventually when we go for that amount of detail. And when electrons change hands from one electron carrier to another within complex three, complex three has enough energy then for pumping some protons. The ratios indicated in this picture are when a pair of electrons, two electrons, like an NADH would have to give, go through complex one, it can add four protons to the gradient. And when a pair of electrons go through complex three, it can add four protons to the gradient. And when a pair of electrons go through complex four, that's this one, complex four, it can add two protons to the gradient. So for a pair of electrons that goes from the beginning of this picture to the end of this picture, one pair of electrons going the entire length of the electron transport chain allows the addition of, let's add them up, 10 protons to the gradient. These are people's best estimates. I should admit that they're estimates and that they've been refined over the years. And that maybe we should still call them estimates, but they're the current best estimates. Keeping track of all these protons is still pretty impossible. The exact proton pumping details are not entirely known. But we do know that these protons are coming from the matrix and going to the intermembrane space. And via some proteins that cross the membrane. Complexes 1, 3, and 4 of the electron transport chain are the proton pumps here. Cytochrome C, discussing the electron transport chain, is going to make me introduce cytochromes. And cytochromes are mostly protein. So cytochrome C is mostly protein. But an understood non-protein helper for anything called a cytochrome is iron with a porphyrin ring around it, what you might call heme. So we're going to take a close look at heme as we examine the components of the electron transport chain, and we're finally going to take a close look at heme. The relationship between heme and cytochrome C is her question. And I was introducing about cytochromes that any cytochrome, cytochrome C or any other cytochrome, would, by definition, just because we called it a cytochrome, would require heme as a cofactor. And there's an iron in the heme that you heard me mention. heme is iron surrounded by a porphyrin ring. You've probably heard me say that word, and it would probably be nice of me to spell it for you. And the learning objectives, eventually we'll make sure I discuss this terminology about heme. Heme is when you have a porphyrin wrapped around iron. When it comes to how many protons from the gradient need to be used to make one ATP, let's say, when ATP synthase uses protons from the gradient to power the synthesis of ATP, how many protons from the gradient does it take to make an ATP? I don't think they should have left it mysterious here. The current best estimate is that it takes 4. It takes 4 protons from the gradient to make an ATP. What was your question?
Still about generalizing about cytosomes in general. Is that true? And they're non-proteinal?
I was generalizing. She asked, was I generalizing about cytochromes in general? And yes, I was. And one of the generalizations I made is that they are mostly protein.
Oh, they are.
Cytochromes are mostly protein. And with an understood non-protein helper. A cytochrome would be a protein that needs heme as a non-protein helper. You're welcome. And I am stepping on the toes of some of these learning objectives coming up in this introduction. So it will get said again when we get to the more formal learning objectives for this information. I was wondering if maybe someone would ask, what about complex 2? I see complex 1, I see complex 3, I see complex 4, what's missing? Complex 2. Well, it turns out that in the next picture of the electron transport chain, we're going to find complex 2, and we're going to find some details about what's inside complex 1, what's inside complex 3, what's inside complex 4. It'll be more detailed about the electron transport chain. The reason complex 2 did not need to be in this picture is because when a pair of electrons comes from an NADH in the mitochondrial matrix, those electrons do not go through complex 2. You see, this picture doesn't show you every possible place for the entry of electrons into the electron transport chain. This picture only shows you one entry point into the electron transport chain. This picture shows you mitochondrial NADHs donating electrons to complex 1. And that's the only thing that complex 1 will take electrons from. Complex 1 will only take electrons from NADHs in the mitochondrial matrix. But there are other ways for electrons from things other than mitochondrial NADHs to get into the electron transport chain. For example, you're realizing already that the FAD2Hs made by the TCA cycle can donate electrons to the electron transport chain. Well, hold on to that thought, and you'll be ready to see complex 2 in the next picture. A little bit of terminology. This is the intermembrane space, not inner membrane space. So be careful about that. Intermembrane space. I see some good textbooks make a mistake there. Don't you make that mistake? This indeed is the inner mitochondrial membrane. And when it comes to the matrix, I don't say inner or outer because there's only one of them. There's only one matrix. The mitochondrial matrix is the space enclosed by the inner mitochondrial membrane. Okay, so I think we've done a great job on learning objective 1. For learning objective 2, look for the middle paragraph on page 382 where they will list the requirements for the generation of ATP by oxidative phosphorylation. And you'll be so ready already for what they say there. They list some things that are pretty obvious just from this diagram and obvious from what you know already. For example, you need an electron donor. In this picture, it's NADHs in the mitochondrial matrix. But like I was just saying, there are other ways for other electrons to get into the electron transport chain that we'll discover soon. But you need an electron donor, kind of obviously. You also need an electron acceptor, kind of obviously. If these electrons are going to change hands, you need an electron acceptor. And it's O2 that ultimately accepts the electrons at the very end and becomes one. You need, and this is the one I sometimes find students have difficulty realizing, you need an intact inner mitochondrial membrane for oxidative phosphorylation to work. Some students try and simplify it in their mind in a way that I'm very critical of and would take off points for. It's not that the electron transport chain makes protons and ATP synthase uses protons. That's a gross oversimplification that doesn't even appreciate the need for a membrane. I want you to make statements that make it clear to me that you understand the need for a membrane here, an intact mitochondrial, inner mitochondrial membrane for oxidative phosphorylation to work. The electron transport chain doesn't make protons. The electron transport chain didn't make these protons. It moved them across a membrane that you need to be very mindful of, the membrane and its importance to this process. And rather obviously, you need these components of the electron transport chain and you need ATP synthase. Not just the membrane, but you need these things in the membrane as well. Electron transport chain components and ATP synthase need to be in that membrane. So some kind of obvious requirements for oxidative phosphorylation mentioned in that paragraph on page 382. Number three, learning objective three, takes me only a second to tell you that an alternative name for the electron transport chain is the respiratory chain. I can even find a few places in this textbook where they call it the respiratory chain, and it's not an uncommon way to refer to the electron transport chain, so I think we need to still recognize it as the electron transport chain, and people call it the respiratory chain. Let's use this picture, and then I'll take you to the next picture before you get away today. Let's use this picture still a little bit longer as we go on to learning objective four now. Learning objective four says to describe the redox reaction catalyzed by each complex of the electron transport chain. So this picture lets me see complex 1, complex 3, and complex 4. Let's do it for each of those. And then in the next picture, let's make sure we do it for complex 2 as well. Where for each complex of the electron transport chain, I want to say what it catalyzes if I think of it as an enzyme. An enzyme that will take electrons from some reactant and give those electrons to some other reactant, facilitating a transfer of those electrons. And right here, we're seeing why I would say that complex 1 oxidizes NADH when complex 1 takes electrons from an NADH. It turns that NADH into its oxidized form, NAD+. And that's oxidation of the NADH. To complete this sentence for what complex 1 catalyzes, I'd like to say, who does complex 1 reduce when the electrons finally leave complex 1 and they're given to somebody outside of complex 1? The electrons, you might have heard me implying in how I said that, the electrons change hands a couple times inside complex 1. But when those electrons are finally given to somebody outside complex 1, allowing complex 1 to go back to the way it was originally, and by giving the electrons to somebody outside complex 1, reducing that thing, who is it that complex 1 reduces there?
Q.
Oh, somebody just found it. Coenzyme Q. Complex 1 reduces coenzyme Q. Now, this picture doesn't get so detailed as to try and show both forms of coenzyme Q, an oxidized form and a reduced form. We'll eventually do that. We'll talk about what coenzyme Q looks like before it gains those electrons and what it looks like after it gains those electrons. In other words, any electron carrier, eventually I'm going to have to describe to you both its oxidized form before it gains electrons and its reduced form after it gains electrons. Because any electron carrier needs to have those two forms and be able to go back and forth between those forms to do its electron carrying job. It needs to pick up electrons and give them away again. Pick up electrons, give them away again. This picture doesn't try and show me, I was saying, both forms of coenzyme Q. It simply shows with those blue arrows the path of electrons and relies on me to understand that the electrons right here are reducing coenzyme Q. But coenzyme Q goes back to its original form again by giving the electrons to follow the blue arrow. Coenzyme Q gives the electrons next to complex 3. So now back to that task I set before us of saying for each complex what that complex catalyzes. What we've gotten to now is complex 3 catalyzes oxidation of coenzyme Q, takes electrons from coenzyme Q, and it oxidizes coenzyme Q back to its original form in this discussion. And the electrons will change hands a couple times inside complex. But I've been calling it, hopefully I've been calling it complex 3. Did I slip up and call it complex 2, Annie? Some of you say, yeah. And I kind of think maybe I did. I'm not sure what I said, to be honest. But let's get back on track that this is complex 3 if I've messed up at all. Okay, so I do remember saying coenzyme Q gives electrons to complex 3. I was okay when I said that. And now back to that task of defining what each complex catalyzes. Complex 3 catalyzes the oxidation of coenzyme Q. Complex 3 does that. Complex 3 catalyzes the oxidation of coenzyme Q. And those electrons will change hands a few times inside complex 3. Maybe that's what I started goofing up. Inside complex 3. But when those electrons finally leave complex 3, who would I say complex 3 is reducing? Cytochrome C. Complex 3 reduces cytochrome C. We'll talk a little bit better later about how cytochrome C carries electrons, how it has an oxidized form before it gains electrons and a reduced form after it gains electrons, and how it can go back and forth between those two forms. But this picture is at least allowing me, in a nice simple overview, to follow the path of electrons. The electrons have now reached cytochrome C, and it gives the electrons to complex 4. So now, back to the task of saying what each complex catalyzes. Complex 4 catalyzes oxidation of cytochrome C by taking electrons from the reduced form of cytochrome C and returning cytochrome C back to its oxidized form again. Complex 4 oxidizes cytochrome C. And then who does cytochrome 4 reduce? Oxygen. Cytochrome 4 is the one that actually reduces the oxygen to water. So that's getting an overview of what each complex does, where I take the perspective of each complex is an enzyme that catalyzes a redox reaction. And I can follow nicely from this diagram what redox reaction would be catalyzed by complexes 1, 3, and 4. I don't have any insight into complex 2 until I go to the next picture. Let's do that. The next picture is going to be figure 21.5. This figure, you see, tries to examine the electron transport chain more carefully. It doesn't show the rest of oxidative phosphorylation. In other words, ATP synthase is not in this picture. ATP synthase is not in this picture. But this picture does a better job than the previous one of showing us the electron transport chain part of oxidative phosphorylation. Here's complex 1 again. I don't know why the artist depicted it the way they did. As I said, it's not just 2 subunits. It's more like 42 subunits that make up the protein part of complex 1. Here's complex 1. And complex 1, we said, oxidizes NADHs in the mitochondrial matrix and reduces coenzyme Q. Now, the best place to find coenzyme Q being reduced in this diagram is right here. I would take out the references to coenzyme Q that you find in this part of the diagram. In fact, there's one arrow, this arrow right here, that is absolutely incorrect. And to fix the situation, just take out all references to coenzyme Q in this part of the diagram. The diagram works great just having coenzyme Q shown over here. And then this broad gray arrow would be how the diagram would have me follow the electrons that, once they're given away by complex 1, they're given to coenzyme Q. Reducing coenzyme Q to a form indicated as CoQH2. It's got a couple extra H's, you can tell from their symbolism in its reduced form. But along with those H's, it also has 2 more electrons. So the reduced form of coenzyme Q, shown right here, has 2 more electrons than the oxidized form of coenzyme Q, shown here. This picture is trying to show me both forms of coenzyme Q and how not only does complex 1 reduce coenzyme Q from its oxidized form to its reduced form, but so do 3 other things in this picture. This picture is allowing me to see some other ways for other electrons to get into the electron transport chain. We had already discovered in the previous picture this way for electrons to get into the electron transport chain, mitochondrial NADH is giving electrons to complex 1. And then we follow those electrons to coenzyme Q gets them next in the previous picture. But what this picture is filling me in on is that coenzyme Q gets electrons from about 4 different places, not just from complex 1. All of these broad gray arrows are things giving electrons to coenzyme Q. Some of these electrons never went through complex 1, but they're being given to coenzyme Q nonetheless. And at that point, everyone would agree that the electrons are in the electron transport chain. Coenzyme Q is going to next give them to, the picture's good right here, coenzyme Q gives the electrons next, no matter who it gets them from, coenzyme Q gives the electrons next to complex 3. This 2P-looking guy here is complex 3. I don't know why it looks like a tooth. It's mostly protein, I know that. And the protein part traverses or crosses the membrane, allowing complex 3 to be a proton pump. For those of you who just can't stand it until you see complex 2, I've got a couple minutes left today to show you complex 2 in this picture. I don't think I get to finish looking at this picture today. I'll have to pick that effort back up on Thursday. But to find complex 2 in this picture before we quit today, here it is. Here's complex 2. There's a Roman numeral 2 right there. It's just this part, just this one right here, that is complex 2. Notice it does not cross the membrane, and it's not a proton pump. How could it be a proton pump, I think, because it doesn't even cross the membrane. However, it is considered part of the electron transport chain. And what it will take electrons from is from succinate, as indicated right here. Now, that's going to oxidize the succinate into fumarate. And if this reminds you of part of the TCA cycle, good, it should. Complex 2, you can see, some people call it succinate dehydrogenase. And when we studied the TCA cycle, we studied that succinate dehydrogenase has sort of a special location, a different location anyway, than the other enzymes of the TCA cycle. Succinate dehydrogenase, I said, is embedded in the inner mitochondrial membrane and might be considered to be part of the electron transport chain as well. So yeah, this is the enzyme that you already know about that changes succinate into fumarate. And the electrons first go to an FAD that hangs out in succinate dehydrogenase. Never gets to go anywhere else. Lives its whole life there in succinate dehydrogenase. But an FAD that you kind of already knew about, because you knew that in this step of the TCA cycle, an FAD becomes an FADH2. And this picture allows me to follow those electrons even further into the electron transport chain, where I realize that next they go to coenzyme Q. So now, as my last statement for the day, let's finish this task of saying what redox reaction each complex of the electron transport chain catalyzes. Complex 2 catalyzes the oxidation of succinate and the reduction of coenzyme Q. That's an overview of what redox reaction complex 2 catalyzes. When you follow electrons through complex 2, you'll see that they came from succinates and that they're going to coenzyme Q. Last question.
Complex 2 and succinate, hydrogenase, they're the same?
The question was, is complex 2 and succinate dehydrogenase exactly the same thing, or is one of them a part of the other? It's probably more proper to say that succinate dehydrogenase is a part of complex 2. But if you call them the exact same thing, I wouldn't get critical. I kept that right as well. Okay. Thank you very much.